Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
In terms of product prices, kind of mixed there.
Dr. Mark Jackanowski is chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board, looking at February milk price forecast.
So cheese prices, we raised 2 cents per pound, reflecting pretty tight inventories. But the other main products, butter, non-fat, dry milk, dry whey, we lowered. Butter, we reduced 5 cents per pound. Non-fat dry is down 4 cents. And dry whey forecast, we reduced 3 cents per pound. Just reflecting, truing up to recent price data. Class prices, class 3 and class 4, were each forecast lower this month. All milk price lowered this month by 45 cents per hundredweight to $22.60 per hundredweight, nearly equivalent to last year, down just 1 penny per hundredweight lower than last year.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So 2024 has really been a tough year for the U.S. cotton industry.
Vice President of Economics and Policy Analysis with the National Cotton Council is Dr. Jody Campeachy.
So we're now coming off of about 3 years of pretty high abandonment in the Southwest area due to severe drought conditions. So the crop was a little lower the last few years. We did have a bit higher acreage last year, 11.2 million acres planted, because right before planting time, cotton prices still looked pretty good relative to competing commodities such as corn and soybeans. So we had a bit higher acreage, but we still had pretty high abandonment, resulting in a crop of about 14.4 million. And, I think what we've been hearing a lot throughout cotton country is we still have a lot of growers who actually haven't sold their 24 crop yet, because prices really dropped tremendously over the last year or so between planting and harvest time. And, as we kind of look at the financial condition of growers, this is 2024 was really the third year of cost exceeding prices. And it's been a tough year, and producers are trying to kind of figure out how they're going to pencil out what they're going to do for next year. And some of this is kind of compounded by just a weak demand environment. So I think most in the industry, in the U.S., in the world, really expected cotton demand to recover faster than it has. So with that in mind, the demand for cotton just isn't there, and there's plenty of cotton available in the world.
Currently, cotton prices hovering around 70 cents, but for many, the break even is above 90 cents. So no surprise.
So we asked growers, what they planted last year and then what they expect to plant this next year. And what they reported this year was a total of 9.6 million acres, and that's compared to 11.2 last year. And, I think if you ask the industry what their expectations were, it's a little lower, I think, than some were expecting, and particularly in some areas like Georgia. Georgia acreage on the survey was reported as 864,000 acres, which would be the lowest level since 1993. We haven't had that many years in recent history where it was below 1 million acres. So, that was one. The other was Texas. And Texas is known to go to have acreage down below 5 million, but, not so much in recent years. I think the last time it was down that low was 2015, because, in the Southwest, you just don't have as many crops to basically alternative crops. So you're still seeing a lot of guys who tend to plant cotton. And again, overall, I don't think anyone's really surprised by it, because looking at the financials for this next year, they may be even worse than last year if we don't get some sort of price improvement. And then it all kind of depends, too, on what happens this year with the Farm Bill. So we're pushing to get the 2025 Farm Bill passed, which would have higher support levels. And, of course, the ideal situation would have it be retroactive to at least cover the 2025 crop as well, depending on if and when it gets passed this year.
An area of growth within the industry had been ELS or Pima cotton.
Yes, and the main reason is, the kind of the same thing for Upland. Economics just don't make sense right now. So for Texas, and then also for, the West, where most of the Pima is grown, in the West, there are some other alternatives outside of Texas, but it's just the cost or the price of ELS cotton is down just like Upland cotton. And so it's just not making sense for growers to plant as much this year.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Yeah, the green screens are gone, the monochrome. There's still roughly 15,000 satellite terminals that some of our farmers still have out there in sheds and barns, and satellite fed, it just sits there and it works.
Doug Marnell is National Account Manager for DTN.
Once the internet became available, we've moved most of our products to either a website version or software, and so, a lot of folks kind of envision DTN as still that satellite terminal, but we're probably more into B&B and working with a lot of agribusinesses with different products and solutions. So we work with a lot of ag retailers. DTN owns Progressive Farm, the magazine, a major farm print magazine. It's been around for 135 years. So we've made some acquisitions with weather companies. I mean, a lot of people see DTN as an ag company, but we've really got three major divisions. We've got an ag, a weather, and an energy division. So we're more of a global weather provider now. So we provide weather to shipping, aviation, transportation. So that's the three different kind of segments of the business.
So what does DTN do today?
On the ag side, for a lot of these ethanol plants, we provide a solution similar to like the old satellite with market data, but it's real time. It's a product called ProfitX. And so, commodity merchandisers can use this data to see what real-time CBOT corn price is doing. We report cash prices all across the country. Farmers can log into a hosted website from DTN and sell grain to the ethanol plant or producer. It's called a grain portal. So we do a lot of that on the front end. And then on the back end, on the downstream side, on the energy side, we actually have terminal automation systems, and we report rack prices and do a lot of stuff on the energy side. I'm not familiar with that part of the business as much, but yeah, we've been integrated with ethanol plants, grain elevators, and so forth for many years. So
he was recently attending the 30th National Ethanol Conference.
We're actually a partner with the Farmers for Soil Health, which is NIFWIF, and we actually have built a website for farmers that want to grow cover crops and sign up to grow cover crops over a 3-year period. And we manage all the financial, the transactions, the payments and stuff through that, and working with the National Corn Growers on that initiative. So we assume we're going to have like a marketplace where a lot of these credits will be able to trade once a lot of the big consumer goods companies come in and into play and so forth. A lot of that's kind of up in the air now with some of the Climate Smart Ag programs being held up or reevaluated from the Trump administration. So especially like 45Z here, the tax credit that ethanol plants could receive to buy more sustainably produced grain, which essentially is grain, corn that's grown on, ground that has either cover crops, minimum tillage, nitrogen inhibitors and so forth. So if you are able to lower that carbon score for that producer and that plant buys that corn from a more sustainably produced grain, there's going to be a tax credit that goes back to that ethanol plant, which some of that money hopefully will be shared with the farmer in a kind of a, rising tide lifts all boats. Because I know just in sitting in one of these sessions, they're looking for ways with these depressed commodity markets to find new avenues for producers to make money off grains.
Just says it's an opportunity for farmers to be rewarded.
Farmers have not been able to be rewarded for, everybody talks about the green, but the farmer has not been awarded for all the things that he's done in the past. I mean, there's farmers that have done no-till and cover crops for 20 years, but they haven't been able to see a financial incentive with it. So I think that's what I'm most excited about is, because farmers are the main stewards of the land, so they're the main conservationists. So if there's some extra dollars to be gained from that, I think that's what I see as a very positive thing on the horizon.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We saw no shortage of swift action from the Trump administration just from the first couple weeks of this new presidential term.
Mary Thomas Hart, Chief Counsel, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
More executive orders than we can count in a quick moment, but certainly some pretty impactful executive orders related to environmental policy, both domestic and international policy. So, we saw the Trump administration pretty quickly, I think on day one, pull back the Biden administration's climate change executive order that required really every agency within the federal government to include climate as a consideration in any rulemaking or action that they took. The Trump administration pulled that back. The Trump administration also pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accord, again, just as they did in 2017. I would say that doesn't mean that our international engagement in the climate conversation stops. We understand that the beef market is a global market, right? And we have consumers all around the world. We have buyers all around the world. So making sure that we stay engaged in those conversations, regardless of who's president, ensures that those conversations, I think, become a more market-driven conversation, and we're really thinking about what consumers want instead of what policymakers demand. Now, back at home, I think, you know, we're going to see programs at USDA and EPA have to kind of comply and figure out how to operate within this new Trump administration without a climate nexus.
What about waters of the U.S.?
Always a hot topic. I think it'll always be a hot topic, unfortunately. But I've been at NCBA for 8 years. We've been fighting WOTUS for longer than that. So on day one, you know, I got the WOTUS briefing. But in 2023, we got a unanimous Supreme Court decision in a case called Sackett versus United States. And the Supreme Court held that the significant nexus test, which was really the standard the EPA had been using to write WOTUS rules for the prior 20 years, was invalid and unconstitutional. So the EPA had to pull that standard back. They published a new rule in the fall of 2023, which complies with that Sackett holding. And I would say, as far as rulemakings go, we're in a pretty good spot, right? We've got a limited WOTUS definition. I think the Biden EPA, kind of out of spite, sent out some internal memos to staff across the country telling them to interpret that new rule in the most aggressive way possible, which is what we've seen in the last 18 months, a pretty aggressive implementation of that new WOTUS standard that should be a lot tighter, a lot stricter. So hopefully during the Trump administration, we can pull back some of those more aggressive guidances, realign the definition with what the Supreme Court intended in the Sackett decision, and move forward from there with something that is, you know, lasting and create some real regulatory certainty for landowners across the country.
And then there's the issue of the Endangered Species Act and NEPA.
Whether it's, you know, ESA or NEPA policy, those certainly impact a pretty broad swath of cattle producers across the country. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this administration treats both NEPA and the ESA. In the past, we've seen the pendulum swing, especially with species relistings and delistings, species that have long since recovered remaining on the list and maintaining protections that maybe allow their populations to grow beyond sustainable numbers. And so, you know, it'll be really interesting to see how this administration treats that. But I think we also have an opportunity within Congress to maybe get some legislative solutions, not just to individual species listings, but to the larger ESA procedure that allows this cycle to continue.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We operate internationally in about 60 countries, so it certainly keeps me on the move. We have staff located all over the world doing a fantastic job for the American farmer and agribusiness.
Ryan LeGrand is CEO, U.S. Grains Council, talks about their recent annual meeting in Austin.
So every February we do our International Marketing Conference. It's basically an annual membership meeting. But this one, at this particular one, our international directors and our deputy directors come in from all of our overseas offices and share our plans, share our strategy with our membership. And that's where our members get a chance to provide input into that strategy and direction moving forward. So it's really our best meeting of the year.
Now, on the heels of that meeting in Austin, the National Ethanol Conference in Nashville.
Last year was a fantastic year for exports. Ethanol exports broke a record. In the crop year of 23-24, it was 1.75 billion gallons, not counting about 140 million that went to Japan in the form of ETBE. Corn exports were up. DDG exports were up sharply. We had Mexico take more DDG than they ever had at nearly 2.5 million tons. And so that at that meeting last week in Austin, we got to share in those successes and talk about how we're going to build upon that going forward. And now here at NEC in Nashville with Renewable Fuels Association, it's all ethanol. And that's a big focus for our organization. For the last 11 years, we've been working on it. 35% of our budget goes towards ethanol market development overseas. So it's a great opportunity to talk with RFA's membership, many of whom are our members as well. So we share that in common. Talk about, you know, with a great supporter and great partner in RFA about all the work we're doing around the world.
One goal of the council is breaking down trade barriers.
We're seeing great success in working on policy overseas, and that's why we've seen the record exports that we had last year. Mexico, we had E10 just a few short years ago, but it was struck down in the Supreme Court. And the previous administration in Mexico never did anything to revive that. Looks like the current administration might be ready to move on a new biofuels law. We've yet to see all the details and how that might work out, but we know that their new president, Claudia Sheinbaum, is a believer in ethanol, having written papers in favor of E20 in Mexico in the past. So she knows the benefits of ethanol from an environmental and an octane standpoint. And so that's Mexico. But we've seen breakthroughs in Japan with them looking to move from their ETBE usage to direct blending in 2030. To E10 levels. We've seen the Philippines move from E10 mandatory to E20 discretionary, hoping to see a mandate there for E20. And the EU and the UK have really taken off as well with their E10 policies. So lots of breakthroughs that we've seen in the last year, especially in a couple of years, I'd say.
But how often do we stop and talk China? Legrand says there's actually an alternative.
They're the most populous nation in the world. They've surpassed China with 1.45 billion people, I think they have. And if we as a country are looking to diversify away from China and not depend so much on that market, India is really the only country that could even come close to moving the needle like they can. There's a lot of things standing in the way. Non-tariff barriers, tariff barriers. India, they've been in the news quite a bit with President Trump talking about how high their tariffs. That's true. They've got some very, very high tariffs, but I'm also hearing talk about trying to negotiate a trade deal by the end of this year with India. That would be fantastic. We have a lot of things that we can trade, especially for what the U.S. Grains Council works to promote: corn, barley, sorghum, ethanol, DDG. All of that can work into India, and we're excited for the future with India.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
No, it's definitely here to stay.
Trevor Hinz is Director of Industry and Government Relations with ICM.
We're very bullish on ethanol. We like the place ethanol is today. We think there's a lot of room for growth. We're planning for industry growth. And it's here to stay. It's here to stay. And now we've got to get to the next level.
So who is ICM?
Sure. ICM is a engineering and technology company that services the renewable fuels industry, specifically the ethanol industry. We're located in Colwich, Kansas, a bedroom community just outside of Wichita, Kansas. And our technology is in well over 75% of the ethanol plants in the U.S., over 60% of North America, and we're actively building ethanol plants down in Brazil. We convert cornstarch to ethanol. Our technology is very good at converting cornstarch to ethanol. That's what the company was built on, and that's what the company continues to thrive on.
But over time, has the industry improved efficiency?
Our plants are as efficient as they've ever been, and they're getting more efficient. So that's something that's very important to our customers. How do we make more with less? How do we make more ethanol with less corn? How do we make more ethanol with less energy, with less water? So that's something we constantly think about, that we constantly work on, is how to make our plants, how to make our customers more efficient, making more ethanol, more distiller's grains with less.
How about year-round E15? Is it important?
We don't think there's anything more important to our industry today than getting E15 legislated to be able to be sold year-round. We've put a lot of energy into that over the last several years. We think we're very close. We think it will happen this year. We're planning for it to happen this year, but there's still some work to do, and we're doing that hard work along with RFA, along with our industry trade groups, doing what we need to do to get that done in Washington, D.C. So we're excited about it. We're still working hard to get it done, and we think it's going to happen.
So if we're talking about year-round E15, are we talking about mandatory E15?
We don't want any mandates. We don't need mandates. Ethanol stands on its own. Ethanol is the cheapest source of octane in motor fuels. And we know if it's just allowed to be sold up to 15%, the industry will evolve there. So we don't want a mandate. We're not for mandates. We just want to be able to sell E15 year-round across the country. When we're allowed to do that, we'll see our industry eventually evolve to the next level. And that's what gets us really excited.
So what are the customers of ICM, the ethanol plants, focused on right now?
So we're talking to our customers about stretching their steel, you know, how to expand their plants, how to make more ethanol. We're talking to our customers about how to recover more corn oil. We're setting the standard when it comes to corn oil recovery, recovering over 80% of the available corn oil. I think we're well over 1.3 pounds per bushel of corn oil now. So we're doing some great work when it comes to recovering corn oil and helping our plants increase their bottom line. Efficiency. Again, our plants want to use less energy. They want to use less water. They want to use, you know, more ethanol from less corn. So expansions, efficiency, corn oil, getting more corn oil, all of those conversations are going on right now with our customers. And, yeah, we're really excited about that.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The thing that I remind us all, though, is a couple of facts.
Mike Murphy is Chief Operating Officer with Cattle Facts.
Number one, since 1980, 80% of the time, wherever your January low in the Fed cattle market was, we took that out at some point in the year. Now, that can vary. Sometimes it's in the spring if it's one of those contra-seasonal kind of crazy markets. Other times it's more traditionally in that late summer window. But that's a very high probability that this kind of that upper 190s area that we are experiencing, that we will take that level out somewhere here this year. So I think that's the first thing we want to be able to make sure of. The second thing that I want to point out, though, is it's hard to see on that particular chart. When we go back and we look at the two last big cash declines and from October of 2023 into December of 2023, we went from 185 to 169 in about 9 to 10 weeks. It was a sharp break in a very short period of time. Basically, July 1 of this year to our low, basically September 1 of this year, we went from 195 to 181. When we do incur breaks in this last couple of times, they've been hard and fast. So when the market does decide to kind of roll over and have that correction, we need to understand that that is our risk, that it's a hard and fast type of a correction. Feeder cattle market. This is one of those markets that is just reflective of what the live cattle market is. Our industry over the course of the last 20, 30, 40 years has evolved and changed a lot. We have a lot more focus on risk management. We have a larger percentage of our industry that actually is managing and hedging those cattle that they did what those deferred live cattle are doing as it relates to the cattle market. And I think we can see that just in the experience here in the course of the last several weeks on both the up and then this correction we've had here just in the last 10 days or so. So from a feeder cattle perspective, as you can see on that chart, I mean, we're probably going to be in a spot that we feel pretty confident about having an average of close to 270 for the year. A full range would be somewhere between 250 to 290, and that would be based as the CME Feeder Cattle Index. We have to remember, as we've come through the course of the last 4 years, going back towards the COVID lows of the spring of 2020, this industry has never experienced the environment that we just went through where the market doubled in value. Think about it, it doubled in value in about a four-year window. There was a lot of money that was made in this market from a cattle feeder's perspective. And over time, as this feeder cow supply that Kevin talked about earlier tightens, and potentially if we go into an expansion phase, tighten more, we will chase the feeder cattle market to keep occupancy, and there'll be a spot where feeders will get higher than maybe what we would be projecting just based on that concept. For the cow-calf audience in the room, we expect to find a very seasonal market when we think about the calf market. Pushing this market towards on a U.S. average 360 to 370 this spring, Obviously, part of that relationship is going to be driven back to what the forage situation looks like for summer grazing programs. But then have a correction, very normal, very seasonal, into the fall. How many heifers we make available to the buyers next fall will really drive that bottom line support or valuation of the calf market. We could see it where potentially it stays supported more or closer to $3.20. And yet if we are for some reason kind of letting those heifers go and not retaining them back at the operation, we could see that back towards $3 to $3.05. But a very seasonal look to the market when it's all said and done with.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Slightly lower production and somewhat mixed prices month over month in USDA's dairy outlook for February. According to World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekanowski,
we reduced our production forecast by 400 million pounds, just reflecting recent data. So the milk production report and also the cattle report, which showed tighter than expected supplies of dairy heifers.
That carried over to adjustments in the dairy balance sheet, both in fat and skim solid imports and exports.
In terms of product prices, kind of mixed there.
However, class and all milk prices were lowered from the previous month. Yet Jekanowski explains for some of the milk class price adjustments.
Some of those changes, especially to the class prices, reflect recent changes in the milk marketing order that had implications for the formulas that define how those class prices are calculated.
The all milk price forecast lowered 45 cents from the previous month, now at $22.60 a hundredweight. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.